Welcome to Single Malt History with Gareth Russell, pouring out your serving of pure, distilled, intoxicating, and occasionally delicious history. I am joined today on Single Malt History by the one and only Dan Jones, Sunday Times best-selling historian, educated at Cambridge, which is absolutely nobody's fault. He is the author of books about the Middle Ages, the Peasants' Revolt, the Plantagenets, the Wars of the Roses, King John, the Crusades, and the Knights Templar. He's presented television series on the six wives of Henry VIII, Queen Elizabeth I, the Norman Conquest, the Great Fire of London, and most recently, the History of Sex. In 2022, Dan turned his hand to historical fiction with his first novel, Essex Dogs, following a group of soldiers fighting in the English Wars against France in 1346. Like the best historical yarns of yore, such as the Three Musketeers, Dan's Essex Dogs takes a cast of fictional heroes or villains, sometimes both, and sets them alongside historical figures like King Edward III, Thomas de Beauchamp, 11th Earl of Warwick, and Edward Plantagenet, nicknamed the Black Prince because of the unique colour of his military armour. This year, Dan returns to our shelves with a sequel to Essex Dogs, Wolves of Winter, which picks up roughly where Essex Dogs left off. Dan, hello and welcome to Single Malt History.
It's very nice to talk to you, Gareth.
So you've likely been asked many times, Dan, but what made you want to include historical fiction in your repertoire and what made you want to tell this specific story?
Well, for quite a long time when I was just writing nonfiction, people would ask me when I was out on book tour or whatever, are you going to write fiction? And I would always say categorically not. I'll make a complete hash of it and bring shame on my family. I was scared of writing fiction. I thought that the stakes were somewhat higher in writing fiction than in nonfiction. But I grew up a little bit, and I also got to the cusp of my 40th birthday, and I'd written 10 big nonfiction books. And those kind of round numbers just kind of got me a little bit itchy to try something different. And also to sort of segue into the second part of your question, I had an idea. the idea evolved over a couple of years, but I wanted to write about a group of ordinary soldiers in the Middle Ages and see war, and as it turned out, the Hundred Years' War, through their eyes, rather than through the lens of chivalry, of knighthood, of sort of derring do, of the obsessions of the chroniclers of the time, and to some degree the obsessions of novelists today. I thought that would be an interesting way to approach a familiar subject, and that's what Essex Dogs was. I picked the Crecy campaign because I thought it had an interesting beginning, which was a landing on the beaches of Normandy, somewhat similar to D-Day in 1944. And I thought it would be sort of an interesting thought experiment, if nothing else, to write a sort of D-Day beach landing in the 14th century, so that the kind of attack of the prose and the just the sort of the energy and drive of the storytelling would feel familiar to anyone who'd watched Band of Brothers or seen Saving Private Ryan or Bob Capper's photos from Omaha Beach on D-Day itself. To set that in the 1300s seemed to me an interesting writing challenge, and that's what the start of Essex Dogs is, and the book really unfolds from there.
Well, both novels are set in the Hundred Years' War. For people who aren't familiar, what is the Hundred Years' War about, and how would you describe it?
Well, the greatest scholar of the Hundred Years' War, Jonathan Sumption, has spent 43 years writing 5 volumes to answer that question, Gareth. So,
good luck.
What is the Hundred Years' War? What's it about? I mean, at its core, it's a long-running series of interlinked conflicts between the English crown and the French crown. Ostensibly, the question is, should the kings of England also be the kings of France? But that question sort of hangs rhetorically for most of the Hundred Years' War, because it's not a realistic prospect until Henry V accidentally achieves it, that the English kings are going to become kings of France. More than that, it's a series of interlinked questions about the rights of English kings as lords in France, about who monopolizes or controls trade in the English Channel, and particularly the ports of Flanders and the merchant towns of Flanders and the ports of Western France. And it's a conflict that sort of evolves, not dissimilar in some ways to the Wars of the Roses, which you can see as a interlinked conflict. I think the Hundred Years' War you see in the same way. The Hundred Years' War also draws in neighbouring kingdoms, Castile, Scotland, the city states, if you like, of Flanders, northern Italy. So it's a monster conflict to understand in terms of its big story. But for me, the attraction of writing a book like Essex Dogs and the sequel Wolves of Winter is to get into that story without having to bother ourselves too much about the complex politics, the macro picture. When you see it from the eyes of ordinary people, one of the joys of doing that is that the characters in Essex Dogs certainly don't really understand, and for the most part don't really care about the big why they're there in terms of the macroeconomics or the high politics. They just know they're there and they've got to muddle through it as best they can. And so that, I think, is an interesting way to look at such a complex story as the Hundred Years' War, and it gives you a very sort of human approach to it.
Yeah, well, on that subject of the humanity offer, one of the things which both books, I think, do brilliantly is capture that sort of micro experience of medieval warfare, the rush of violence, the confusion of it, often the pain and chaos of it, but also these very long journeys, the lack of clear information that they're dealing with. In both The Quiet and The Fury, you do see the bond between the men at the center of the novel grow tighter. What kind of research did you do for battle conditions versus traveling conditions? And is one better documented than the other?
There's an awful lot of, there's a big literature on arms and armor in the Middle Ages. Tobias Capwell being the sort of the greatest living scholar of all of that, but also, you know, historians like Michael Livingstone have done a lot of really interesting work on the topic. The bits that interested me were actually the less well documented stuff. I mean, it's useful as a novelist to know, for example, on the Cressy campaign, what the lords were eating every day, and one can find that out because the kitchen records of Edward III's kitchen, the cooks still exist. So there's lots you can find out about the nitty gritty of arms, armor, conditions in camp, and so on. There's lots of that information. But for me, the interesting bits to sort of burrow into as a novelist were the things that are in some ways unresearchable. You know, it's the moments of boredom, it's the downtime, it's the hanging around, scratching your ass, not knowing what angle someone's going to try and kill you from next. And those bits I found were the most interesting, in some ways challenging to recreate, but in other ways the most interesting, because you're drawing on a broader the broader topic of human experience and trying to create empathy across time. Those are the challenges of that pertain much more, I think, to the novel than to a work of nonfiction. So it's definitely an interesting transition to make from writing nonfiction to writing fiction, because you're dealing with whole areas that in fiction that are in some senses unresearchable.
Well, this interview is essentially me trying to dance through it without giving away any spoilers. So I'll ask about one of your band of fictional characters who I find sort of sympathetic and admirable and frustrating and very tragic all at the same time, which is Romford. But before I get to him, we again see historical figures sort of flit across the pages here. Sometimes it's briefly, like with Queen Philippa, or major returning figures like her husband, Edward III. I imagine there's sort of the work of both historian and novelist involved there, because there are details on what these medieval people were like in life, but there's usually not enough to sustain a fully fledged portrait. So that's the part of the joy of historical fiction, I think. How do you go about deciding how to add to their personalities or appearance when you're including them in the novel?
That's a really good question. I mean, part of the appeal is definitely And part of the appeal of writing historical fiction in the 14th century, for example, is you have just enough to go on,
right,
in terms of sort of distinguishing characteristics, but lots and lots and lots of scope to drive the characters any way you want, and then to have fun, you know, to come up with interesting reasons for a character doing something that's known historically that might not be the reasons that people assume they did such a thing. So what's a good example? There's a sort of semi-return. Yeah, there's a returning character in both books, which is Sir Thomas Holland, who students of Edward III's reign will know was married at one point to Joan, the Fair Maid of Kent, who went on to marry her first cousin, the Black Prince, and was therefore the mother of King Richard II. Holland, we haven't got to this bit in the Essex Dogs trilogy yet, but Holland will marry Joan of Kent, who's sort of, you always hear about a cousin Joanie somewhere just off the page. not many people know very much about Thomas Holland because it's very hard to, he's not a character that's easy to bring alive in terms of his personality. We just don't know enough about him. But there's one distinguishing characteristic that as soon as I lighted upon it, I thought that's going to give me a lot to work with. And that's that Thomas Holland had lost an eye fighting against the pagans in Prussia on one of those sort of very late stage Northern Crusades. And so the idea that you have this sort of rather heroic knight with a kind of bandage over one eye, I just found gave me something to ruminate on. And he has this interesting trait, which I've completely invented in the books, which he likes to sort of wink mischievously at people, which has a peculiar effect when he's only got one eye. And little things like that. That's pure invention, but plays around with known historical features. In Wolves of Winter, we encounter Sir Hugh Hastings, a real life character. At one point was Edward III's captain in Brittany, led a small, a second army in northern France during the Crecy campaign, joined up with the main army on the Calais, at the Siege of Calais, which is where we encounter him in Wolves of Winter. There's a great article in the Norfolk Archaeological magazine from the 1970s, which describes the opening of the tomb of Sir Hugh Hastings, which happened in the 70s because they were moving the very famous tomb brass on top of his tomb in the church in Elsing in Norfolk. And one of the things that was discovered when Sir Hugh Hastings' tomb was opened in the 1970s was that he seemed to be wearing a wig. Possibly a hat, but I prefer to go with wig, that was made of cowhide. And that small detail, I mean, I knew Hugh Hastings was going to be an important character in the book, but something about the fact that there was, you know, this enormously vain knight, but who was also extremely rough. You know, we also know from the opening of his tomb that Hugh Hastings had lost teeth, had broken his nose, had, you know, fractures all over his body from fighting. All his life, and yet was sort of vain enough to have commissioned himself a wig made out of cowhide. Those are, you know, known historical archaeological details, but they give you a huge amount to start building fictional character with. So that's, you know, those are two examples of great fun I've had with real historical characters, taking known historical traits and then evolving them into sort of growing a personality out of what you've got from the history.
Well, to one of the fictional characters that I mentioned earlier, to poor old Romford, one of the central band in the novel, along with Welsh archers, Scottish warrior, farmwife, priest, father, and a captain. But Romford also, as well as being one of the band, I think emerges as something of a loner, increasingly so in Wolves of Winter, and desperately sad at times. Mm-hmm. He's personally my favorite to read about. And I know, Dan, I'm aware asking this, that this is an irritating and or impossible question to ask. But do you have a favorite character from The Dogs to write?
Yes, but it changes. So, Romford is an interesting character to write. Romford is 16 years old. as is the Black Prince at the outset of these this story that will continue over three novels. And I thought it would be interesting to have a sort of counterpoint to this teenage prince given nominal command of the vanguard of the army with a sort of street urchin of the same age tagging along with a bad. I just thought that would be an interesting sort of device throughout the novels, and their paths intersect. I do like writing Romford because he's an infuriating character, and is just a very, very interesting character to explore. He's mercurial. He's very talented. He's also completely hopeless. And you just want to, like, sometimes you want to slap him. Sometimes you want to give him a big hug. He's just quite a subtle character with quite a lot of depth to him. But I also like writing I wouldn't call them comic turns per se, but you've got Scotsman, one of the dogs, who's a sort of a gigantic, violent, swaggering, drinking, but has this sort of tender streak running through him, which he's annoyed that he has. But my favourite, probably in terms of sort of pure swag, is to write the Earl of Northampton. William de Boon.
Yes. Yeah.
Who is the constable of the army and therefore sort of, one of the top brass. Very little is known about William de Boon. The Boon family, eventually Mary Boon is Henry V's mother, but this is a few generations before that. He's a kind of pal of the king, so he can speak truth to power. Edward III surrounded himself with his mates, who he knew, I think, would tell him the truth. The Earl of Northampton is the only one of the nobles in this trilogy so far who really has any degree of sympathy, empathy, or understanding with the ordinary men. When he first appears, he seems totally and utterly ghastly, foul-mouthed, obnoxious, exasperated, irritable. But as the story unfolds, he's the only one who's really got a shred of humanity, even if he doesn't have much patience. And so he's great fun to write. And he also gets a lot of the best lines because there's a great deal of inventive blasphemy, I'm sorry to say.
I was very impressed with your knowledge of the saints, Dan, I have to say. That was all through the blasphemy.
I mean, I have the golden legend beside my as I'm writing. Because, of course, I'm sure all your listeners will know, but in the Middle Ages, swearing is swearing. It's not scatological and gynecological as it tends to be today. It's like swearing great oaths by religious figures. So God, Christ, and the saints. And so the most foul-mouthed of the characters tend to be the most inventive with their blasphemy and coming up with by the ex-body part of ex-saint was a great parlor game.
There was one, Dan, about, I can't remember the exact one, but I thought, oh, that's niche. I like it. It was something about poor old barbecued St. Lawrence.
Oh, I think it's, St. Lawrence's arse on the griddle or something. Which is good because, you go through a set, I flick through the Golden Legend and look for the sort of the inventive martyr stories of these early Christian saints. And if they've been stuck on the barbecue or sort of hacked into a number of pieces, or if a particular part of their body has been particularly revered as a relic over the years, then in it goes. It's jolly good fun to write.
No, that was it. Sorry, I was still laughing about St. Lawrence, which patron saint of comedians, so I suppose that's fair enough. Dan, for those whose appetites for war novels, barbecued St. Lawrence, and medieval savagery have been appropriately whetted, Wolves of Winter is out this week in the UK and Ireland. When is it out in the US and Canada, where I think it's already available for pre-order?
It's out in the US in January.
Fantastic.
Canada falls somewhere in the middle, I believe. I think it's like November in Canada. Somewhere I have all these dates written down, and very frequently people tell me to remember the publication dates of my books, and I'm afraid I'm hopeless.
Small details, Dan, small details.
Pre-orders are open
with
every territory, and we really, really, really like pre-orders. So I invite everybody to pre-order at least one copy of each book.
Yeah, we love a pre-order. Absolutely. Listen, Dan, massive thanks for joining me today to discuss Wolves of Winter. I'll also reshare this, everyone, in January again for the US release. Dan's joined us today to discuss Wolves of Winter, his sequel to his novel Essex Dogs. Join me next week for an episode on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. I've been Gareth Russell. Thank you and take care.